I'm not sure that if we get any information from like the deaf community or some of these other populations, that it will be that useful in terms of figuring out what are barriers that are unique to that population that we want to be addressing, as opposed to barriers related to COVID that may be unique to that population but are still primarily COVID related, right? So I wouldn't want us to go to a lot of work to collect information from, particularly from specific or vulnerable populations that then we weren't able to really use as well because COVID kind of drowned out any distinctions between the barriers that they were facing and barriers that other people were facing.
I 100% agree. And this has been, I think, that sort of informed our difficulty last month in coming up with a topic, given how broad the topic we chose for the needs assessment is. And it has been really a challenging for me, in sort of in the intervening period to think about what we look at, because COVID and quarantine and everything that happened within the last, 12 months has, really does overwhelm all other concerns in a lot of ways. And it's hard not to, duplicate work. It's hard not to, know that what we're doing is always going to have an asterisk next to it because it is right now. Although it does occur to me, other conversations I've had is one of the main utilities of the COLA is that because it is not specifically mandated by HRSA, we can do more prevention-based populations. And so maybe we should just really focus on coming up with at least one very specific prevention-based target, and just see and go from there. And I'll be honest with you, we can revisit this through the year. We can, as things change and evolve situationally, we can, we can always come up with another target towards the end of the year if we have capacity.
Right, like maybe
Well,
we
it's
wait and see what comes up in the larger one and then decide to drill down on a particular population or issue that we want to know more about.
and I may have more information for you, ideally by midsummer, about what that looks like. I often have sort of some beginnings of conclusions, but at that point, so.
So, you know what, I just want to say, I still think the ASL language group would be great as a COLA. We've never done anything about them in a needs assessment or a COLA. My interactions with people I know who are deaf, there's no information out there and prevention that's written up correctly for them to read. The one video that's out there is actually, it's written in the grammar, it's signed in the grammar of English and not sign language. So it's still very confusing. And they have a huge rate of HIV infection because they can't negotiate sometimes, or they don't know how to negotiate with their sexual partner. So I see there's like a huge upside for this.
That seems like a fairly compelling argument for it. I don't know. Honestly, I don't know a whole lot about. I don't have a whole lot of interaction with deaf people in general. I have, I've had a couple clients over the years who have had some hearing challenges. One that was actually deaf. But so I guess my main concern is how do we access that population? Because I don't know if there's any sort of specific population or specific organization that is sort of overlapping both, hearing impaired and at risk for HIV and HIV positive, or, some sort of Venn diagram of that. But I'm open, I'm game to give it a shot. I mean,
Okay. I mean, I know a few people I could reach out to, and I think part of the problem is they, from what I've heard from some people, is they end up either not going to care or not going for treatment because there's nobody there that signs, you know? And I think we know many agencies, some of them are great and have basic sentences in sign language, And then, but it's very limited. So, you know, and I know that, what is it? The Frontline Workers Group is working on getting a video done about sign language for prevention and care. And I really have advocated for the last couple of years with that. So I just feel like they're a totally unresourced community.
So,
sorry, can I, before you jump in, Thomas, Ben suggested something in the chat around, you know, having sort of respondent driven referrals, meaning sort of building on who we have, you know, if we get a couple, we can maybe build upon that. What that might look like is instead of doing what we have done in the past, which is a focus group, a one-time only focus group for COLAs, is something closer to what we do for the needs assessments, one-on-ones. So we could, you know, start with, you know, one or two referrals and build and interview them as we get them, and see where we are at that point. It is a little bit, you know, it feels tenuous because we're like, oh, what if we just, nobody shows up and we get no referrals, then we've sort of committed to a thing that we aren't able to sort of follow through with. But it seems like, you know, right now is the time to sort of be creative in our methodology. So works for me. Thomas? You're muted.
Thank you. I was just curious. It's a interesting population, right? So obviously, how big is it? And is my, like, can we do some preliminary estimates of what the need is before kind of voting on it? It's really my initial thought. It's like, and then the other piece is, it's like with being blind, there's like a legal definition, and then there's a spectrum of people that have some hearing ability, and, you know, there's people that fall within the spectrum. So do we need clarity on how people fall into the definition of deaf? So that's my other thought, knowing anything about the population.
Like every other population that we approach, I think it's going to be self-report. If you consider yourself deaf, I'm willing to take your word for it. If you have a hearing disability, regardless of its severity, you know, I think that we are willing to sort of, you know, approach a spectrum along those lines. As far as the sort of the quantity of them, the one of the good things about the COLA is that this is the sort of community engagement effort that is best suited for small subgroups. Because the whole point is that we're looking at lots of different small subgroups. As I said, we've done groups as small as like four people, and its real utility is that we can then, if we have a sort of consistency in our data acquisition methods, we then can sort of aggregate them together and compare them over time. That is how I find it to be most helpful. So size of the population often is a moot. But I hear why it's important. If it's like three people total, it's hard to make any sort of policy arguments around the anecdotal experiences of three people. But I'm guessing it's going to be, especially if we include at risk for more prevention based, focus, then I think it's going to be a larger group than we, you know, than maybe we might expect. But I have no idea, honestly.
I mean, if you want, I can reach out to the ASL interpreter program at City College. I know a few people there. I know I have quite a few friends who are deaf. I can reach out to them. And this came to me because I was out one night and ran into my friend, and we started talking about this. And he said, do you know how many, there's 10 of us here. Do you know how many of us are positive? And I was like, I don't know. And he said 9 out of his friends. So there's 22 million deaf people supposedly in the US. The four largest cities they are grouped in is Washington, New York, Boston, and San Francisco. So, but I'm happy to do you know, do some work.
And I think you mean the combination of both deaf and gay.
Right. Right.
Does he? Do you? Is that what you were stating those numbers?
Oh, no, no. I just, you know, I should have refined that. Yeah. I was looking at just deaf people in the US. So.
Yeah.
And I could do further.
I'd appreciate that, TJ. That'd be helpful for this conversation. And I do like, I think Dave said the concept, my little interactions with that community is it is tight knit. And so a group setting might not be as helpful. The privacy of kind of one-on-ones would probably be beneficial to protect confidentiality.
Well, also, you know, our sort of limitations right now around COVID technology and having translation into American Sign Language, because I don't know about Valerie or Melina, but I don't sign. So probably doing this in a written format is going to be the most effective way to go about it. That may just sort of dictate how we approach this.
You can always learn, Dave.
I mean, I suppose I can learn to do almost anything.
There you go. I love
whatever whatever you guys need from me, just give me some time and I'll learn.
But also some of the kids, some of the people learning interpretation or some of the interpreters I might know could donate some time.
Thank you. So how do we, it sounds like there's a fair amount of energy from at least one of you here. How do the rest of you feel about this?
I think both sound like great COLAs. So that's 2 out of 3.
Yes, me too. I think they'll be great. And I was wondering, like, if we can maybe add something on the survey and find out how people were feeling about telehealth services. So I think this would be good too. So that's my opinion about that. And then that might be a cooler for next year. And also, again, if you all need help with translation in Spanish or Portuguese, I'll be always willing to support.
Thank you. That is helpful. Because we are doing a comprehensive needs assessment. It's a comprehensive needs assessment across the spectrum of care, yet where they focus on a specific experience, which is different than anything we've done previously. I will need additional language support around translating the survey materials and all of that into Spanish and Portuguese. And probably I'll have to find somebody who can help me translating into Mandarin as well. I think those are the more common languages that we end up coming across.
Can I ask, when we say at risk for HIV, what's that mean to folks?
I mean, I'm generally going by the sort of CDC, the breakdown that's given to us by CDC, sort of people at greatest risk. Again, it's self-report. If you feel like your lifestyle is such that you are at risk for HIV, I'm going to go take your word for it.
Okay.
I'm interested in hearing both Valerie and Melina's perspectives on these, since they are going to be doing a significant amount of work on this. Do either of you have thoughts? Do either of you sign?
I do not sign, but I would definitely like trying. I don't really know how much time I would have. This would be my first COLA, so I don't know how much time I have to learn how to sign, but they sound like great targets, so I'm excited. That's my sentiment.
I also don't know how to sign, but I would be interested to learn more about this population. And yeah, it sounds good to me.
All right, so Derek, if you would like to lead your peers here in a vote, we can probably just vote on them as a slate unless people feel like they need to be separated.
I do feel the need to say that I don't sign either. So just since I've put staff on the spot to identifying their signing capabilities.
Sorry about that. So in terms of the vote, we're looking at ASL services or ASL language capacity, correct? And there was a second piece. What was the second piece again?
Housing, housing instability.
The transitional housing.
Transitional housing, or how do we, I mean, it's up to you guys. How broad do we want to make this? Do we want to make it specifically about shelters, transitional housing, housing instability in general? Housing instability could get real broad. What do you think?
Go ahead, Derek.
Go ahead, Thomas.
I just have my own personal curiosity with regards to the DPH's role in the SIP hotels and the overdose kind of, what's the last word I want to say in that sentence? Trauma, I want to say embarrassment for lack of a better word. So I'm just curious about that professionally. So I don't know how to address some of that curiosity within this COLA, but I just want to kind of call that out. I think it would be really helpful to understand how sheltering in place kind of led to additional overdoses.
So are you suggesting a third COLA here?
No, just the concept of, it sounds like the populations that we're working with within this will be that same population, so.
Yeah, I mean, it is pretty standard, standard operating procedure to interrogate mental health and substance use in as far as the questionnaires go and so forth. So at least some of that's going to get touched on. And depending on how this really plays out modality-wise, if it is a focus group or it is a one-on-one interviews, which, you know, is going to be more challenging for the ASL piece, but, or just sort of hearing impaired, maybe we'll call it that. But, you know, if for the sort of housing piece, it's possible we could actually, I think at this point, there's enough people who that we have capacity to maybe do something via Zoom, like a focus group via Zoom. And in that case, we do often when we sort of get into that it often comes around. Substance use, mental health are two big points of conversation pretty consistently. So I would be surprised if your curiosity is not satiated there, Thomas. You know, I don't know.
Yeah, and that overdoses aren't, I mean, it's not complicated. We know why they were happening.
Yes.
Okay. So let's do this as two separate votes in terms of how many people would want to do one over the others. Is that correct? That's what we're looking at, like at least one of these two.
I think we can go with both. We can suggest both and see where we go from there. My sense is that we can probably organize the housing one a little more rapidly and then maybe reel in the sort of hearing impaired one as it comes to us as we develop some strategies around it. That's just, you know, my perspective, but your call.
Okay. Actually, I hear what you're saying, David, and I kind of get the feeling that many of the members, because I was seeing some of the shaking of the heads, kind of agree with like, let's vote on them as a pair. And so this isn't a roll call vote. So I'll just ask for the shelter, the transitional housing and shelter instability over the pandemic and SIP and the deaf, hearing impaired, and ASL language capacity services be accepted as our two incoming COLAs for this year.
May I interject really quickly? A piece that I did not, a detail that I did not cover here with you and is your decision. In the past, we have not incentivized COLAs other than sort of generally a meal or something along those lines. But over this past year, we did incentivize the one COLA we did complete. If you want to continue to incentivize with the idea that we might again still be looking at smaller than average participation and people need money and things more than ever, again, your call. If you decide to incentivize it because it does include money, it would need to be a roll call vote. Just a sort of point of order.
So let's start off there then. I figure it would be okay then, because to be perfectly honest, I just go yes. I won't speak for my colleagues here. So let's start that off as a roll call vote then. And that is to incentivize the upcoming COLAs. And I think that's proper, correct? That would be proper procedure. And then to go on and just vote on the COLAs themselves. So let's begin as a roll call for...
Weren't we going to have a little bit of discussion about narrowing the definition of housed or unhoused or something along those lines? Dave, you started that sentence and I responded and then I don't think we finished it.
Sorry, since Derek has made the motion here, let's do that and then we can get to the defining the actual thing once the vote is done with, just as a process thing.
Not a problem, okay.
Thank you.
The motion is specifically whether or not we're gonna incentivize COLA participation.
Yes, thank you. I'll call names and TJ Lee.
I'm mute.
I'm sorry, you're on mute. I'm sorry, Amanda.
Yes.
Laura Thomas.
Yes.
Ben.
Yes.
Richard.
I'm sorry, I had to step away for a moment and you are...
Oh, I'm sorry. We're doing a roll call on voting on incentivizing the incoming COLAs.
I apologize. Yes, definitely.
Eric?
Yes.
Thomas?
Yes, and I need to jump off, so thank you all.
All right, thank you. Nee?
Yes.
And Beth, you...
She's not a member.
Oh, no vote for me. Right. Thank
Sorry
you.
About
no.
that.
Not at all.
Sorry, thank you. Sorry about that. So it seems that that's a clean slate and that is a yes to incentivizing the upcoming COLAs. Thanks, everyone. And so now we're looking at both these COLAs as like these are the incoming... procedures, and then we'll go back to narrowing that definition. Is that okay? So for anyone who, just making it easy, for anyone who opposes these two COLAs as incoming COLAs, just raise your hand or state whether you're opposed to them. Otherwise, we'll take it as assent. All right, so these are our incoming COLAs. Thank you, everyone.
Okay.
Again, that's a clean assent. And so I think the discussion goes back to molding a little bit more what we mean by transitional housing and shelter instability. And I'll throw it back to you, David, for discussion, or do you want me to process that?
I guess my question is, how broad do we want to take this? Again, some of this is probably going to get covered under the needs assessment. So we would maybe want to avoid having it be sort of too duplicative or duplicative at all, if possible, though unlikely. do we want to focus just on SIP housing, like subsidized SIP housing? Because that would be a thing. Or we could focus on, transitional and shelters, just transitional. What sounds good to you?
I'd be interested in current or former SIP residents.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that, Eric?
Yeah,
I was trying to understand what you're saying.
I'd be interested in narrowing it to just current or former SIP hotel residents.
Me too.
Narrow is better. I agree. Anyone have a conflict with that? Sounds like we're in agreement.
All right. So with that said, then we'll just adjust the COLA to current and former SIP residents.
Okay.
And I think that's the last vote. So that's the last vote. So the COLAs now read as current or former SIP residents over the pandemic. The hard of hearing or hearing impaired ASL language capacity, service capacity in our system. With that, I will move on to the next meeting.
Hold on.
Nope.
Really quickly, I wanted to give you guys an update on where we are with the needs assessment process. Those of you who have gone through this before know that all of the materials are tailored specifically to the population we're looking at. So I have been working on doing a couple different versions of our materials. I'm looking at Melina's question. I think that because they're COLAs, then yes, we probably should allow for mixed sero status on both, unless the group doesn't decides they want to be. I mean, the SIP stuff is going to be, both of them could be covered under that. Sorry. Does anybody want to weigh in on that before I continue with these assessments?
Right, because I don't think we had a full enough discussion exactly on that point. Though I think when you were introducing the idea, David, you were talking about it in terms of looking at a prevention COLA as well.
Yes.
But this could work, both these COLAs could work as mixed sero status COLAs.
Yes.
So I would be for them.
Okay.
Does anyone have any opposition to that? then yeah, let's move forward with them as mixed zero status colas.
Okay.
Thank you, Melinda.
So continuing on. I'm tailoring the version of the needs assessment materials. I'm doing two slightly different versions. One with the idea that we may still be doing things via Zoom or remotely for a little while. So last year's needs assessment survey was a sort of qualitative survey with some long form questions attached, as well as the ranking attached. So I'm putting that together, and I'm also putting together just a qualitative survey with the idea that we may do some individual interviews and or like focus groups where we can take notes of people, you know, verbal back and forth, conversational, more of a conversational mode. Additionally, it occurred to me that a lot of what we're really thinking about here is not just what the sort of consumers of services, consumers of Ryan White funded services, what their experience has been, but I think more than ever in this one, hearing from providers and how they have adapted to the past 12 months and things, lessons learned, challenges, and so forth, I think should be a larger component than usual, just because capturing all of that information, I think is very important, and sort of seeing those side by side, seeing how providers felt like they have adapted and was that effective from a consumer perspective and vice versa. So generally I don't do the provider section until I have some, at least some amount of data on the consumer side that can guide my questions to providers. So I can sort of specifically tailor it towards what we're hearing from consumers. But this time, I think I'm going to do that process in parallel. I may just do the provider section and try and hit it a little. Because we're doing a more comprehensive, we can really reach out to kind of everyone provider-wise. Thoughts on that? Thoughts on how I approach that? Any sort of suggestions on what that looks like? I'm open to your feedback. Nothing? I'm so surprised. Ben, really? No, you're usually here to disrupt my plans. You don't have any disruptive blue sky thinking.
That is not true.
I not in a bad way. Sometimes in a, you know, way that I don't always love initially, but I'm open to, because we're sort of reinventing some of these processes and perspectives, additional perspectives are helpful.
I can't think of any right now at this second.
Okay. Well, with Thomas gone from the call, who else am I going to rely on to, you know, TJ?
I think it was already disruptive enough, so, you know.
Okay.
I had not about this, Dave, but what I feel stupid, but what Melina just asked about mixed sero status. So that means people with HIV and people with not HIV?
Yes.
I thought we just dealt with things that involve HIV clients. I didn't know.
Because after the merge a few years ago, we are now the Prevention and Care Council and combined. And so we are overseeing CDC funding as well as HRSA funding. Therefore, we do have a responsibility to speak to prevention concerns.
I think it's all good. I just didn't understand.
I'm explaining why that sort of shifted relatively recently within the past few years. But the needs assessment, because it is specifically a HRSA requirement, has to focus on HIV positive people. That is part of the reason why we rely on the COLA to sort of give us a broader picture of, you know, HIV negative people as well.
Thank you.
So one of the things that I am looking at is, as far as those long form answers for the survey, what should I be asking? What do we want to know? I mean, I think in a verbal format, just doing a focus group, I wouldn't necessarily struggle so much with, or not struggle, but would make a lot more sense, because it's very sort of organic and fueled by the sort of conversation that people I'm having with people. But with the sort of written long form questions as part of the survey, I kind of only get one shot at it, and I want to be able to make sure that the questions we're asking are effective questions, that they get to the things that we want to know. And specifically thus far, I've added in questions around, like, you know, generally we start with a, what is your general quality of life sort of question over the past 9 to 12 months. Following up with that, I've asked a question that is essentially, what specific challenges or successes have you seen in maintaining medical engagement and or access to services during COVID quarantine, specifically? And there's always a few questions around sort of like, what services are most important to you as an individual, as a part of a community? And sometimes they break them out. Sometimes they only focus on one or the other. And what services have you not been able to access or do not exist as far as you know that you need? Those are pretty standard. I'm planning on adding into the sort of both mental health, substance use, and mental and medical care questions further up, asking a basic sort of yes, no, have you accessed, you know, telehealth services for all three of those things? What am I missing?
Can I add one?
Yeah, please. Suggestion?
Sort of what services might you hope for or recommend that aren't currently available?
Yeah, that's actually one that's in there, but okay, yes. And as always, I will bring this sort of a draft of this to you guys to review before it's finalized. I just thought putting a few heads together to inform the thought process might be helpful. Sometimes I get, you know, working on it by myself, I can go in circles a little bit.
Yeah, I wonder if it'd be useful to do like some storytelling about significant moments. And maybe that'll be helpful for the written long form ones, perhaps.
Yeah, because that would definitely come out in a focus group or an individual interview. But this is what I'm saying is, you know, what are the things that we miss in the long form questionnaire? Thank you.
Too, if there's a question around certain pieces of equipment or people or whatever that would have like maybe helped ensure a better connection to any of the types of care that we're asking about, like I think a lot about digital divide, but also just isolation and how people are able to access different services.
Okay, so it's not just did you access or how effective was accessing it for you, but what things kept you from accessing it. So did you access? If not, why? And maybe more of a sort of what services and or tools would have been helpful?
Yeah, that sounds good.
Anything else? Richard, what was your experience? Like, you don't have to share everything, but like, were there things during, you know, while you're staying at the Kinney that I know that Kinney has some very inherent challenges built in. Are there things that you feel like a way that I could ask people about things that you may have seen experienced or that you personally experienced that I'm missing?
I noticed that there used to be outside people that came in for like rap sessions and things like that. They had nutritionists, you know, just some of the groups that they ran. Obviously COVID shut them down. There was just a lot of isolation. People did seem to have the phone and they had technological abilities, but I'm just speaking for what there's a lot of substance use going on in these places. I might just allude to that. And that's an issue. Yeah, that's all I can think of. There's a lot of substance use. People were isolated. There was no real contact with the outside. Like people, like even TJ and them used to come in, and those groups stopped because of COVID. And I think that was missed.
Okay. So maybe something like, you know, what things sort of disappeared completely? Because some things we were able to sort of pivot and transition to a sort of telehealth, telepresence version of it, or phone, Zoom, so forth. But what things were lost completely, service wise?
Yeah, and there were a couple of overdose deaths, and it was a small community, so everyone knew each other, and it affected people.
Okay. I mean, I think that in some ways is maybe a question that we should keep in mind, Valerie, Melina, for the housing. The SIP housing is very specifically asking questions around overdose, and not just, and more around how did the idea of being sort of isolated within a space, within a hotel, with a population, because anytime you isolate a group of people, we've all watched enough dumb reality shows where, you know, those things reverberate much more, you know, intensely when you are trapped, you know, trapped in a space, you know. So something like an overdose is something we should figure out a way to get to without using excessively triggering language, which is always going to be an issue when discussing these kind of things. So maybe keep it in the back of your mind so that if I forget, you remember. Thank you.
Dave, I don't know if this would be covered under the technology, but I know one thing dealing with some of the people at the Kinney and some other places, would they have their little pay-by phones, you know, not a smartphone, then they choose not to engage, whether because they only have a few minutes to use their phone. And so that becomes a problem. Do they use their phone, you know, to talk to their friends to try to feel better, or reach out to, you know, a case manager or somebody else? So we were trying to figure that out on how to do that without like actually mailing somebody, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because then they also don't have access, without a smartphone, they don't have access to email. So they were really kind of cut off.
So maybe a follow-up question to the tools and services around, specifically around technology, because it, you know, it does occur to me that, like, you know, the people who have the sort of lifeline cell phones don't necessarily get the same data package that the rest of us are willing to pay for, and their internet time is going to be severely limited. And if they don't have reasonably good Wi-Fi where they're living or at all, how does that isolate them even further? So I'm just going to not note that down as sort of like a technology follow-up and figure out a way to you know, wordsmith it later.
Okay. Thank you, Dave.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not certain exactly where this fits, but I do know that there were some folks that literally lost use of their phone. They couldn't pay for them, or for one reason or another, their data plan was restricted. So I'm always wondering about how many people were affected by that sort of loss and connecting with telehealth services or just services overall.
Yeah, I mean, I know that, you know, clients lose their phones all the time. I mean, ideally, if they're staying home, there's less places for them to actually have lost it. But in a time where your phone is literally a lifeline, that's much more important. So we should definitely figure out a way to get into that with a little more detail. Well, it feels like this is a good place to start. If something occurs to you, you can always email me and we'll discuss it next month. Ideally, I will have a draft of both different versions of the survey. I mean, that's not true. I'm going to bring you the one with the long-form questions, because the one without the long-form questions is basically going to be the same thing. For you guys to give final approval over. And if anything comes up between then and now, you can let me know.
All right, great. Thanks, Dave. So we'll be looking forward to that for next month's meeting, which is May the 5th, Wednesday, May the 5th. And unless there's anyone has any sort of item that they want to bring up really fast, we can end it a bit early here. All right. Thanks, guys, for coming out for this meeting, and see you next month.
Melina and Valerie, can you hang on for just 1 second?
Bye, everyone.
Bye, Richard.